much these boys can put away.
Pick up a 12-pack of Pepsi 12-ounce bottles for just $3.98, and a family-sized bag of Doritos is only $3. Ritz crackers are just $1.96 for a 16-ounce box. Don't forget a few 12-inch DiGiorno Ultimate pizzas for only $5.98 each. Come to Walmart for everything you need for game time. Save money, live better. Walmart.
Good Campbell's. Cheesy chicken and rice casserole. Possibilities. Make a real meal in minutes. Your whole family loves to eat. With the cheesy hot casserole, wholesome food is such a treat. Find an easy online recipe, so delicious for your family. Good Campbell's casserole. Possibilities.
Find this and other delicious casserole recipes at campbellskitchen.com.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX, the official station of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
For weather, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, call the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026, a service of Union State Bank. When Union State Bank says, do business with us, do better with us, it's true. Get a 6-month super low introductory rate on their popular home equity credit line. No points, no closing costs, no restrictions on how to use the money. Call 1-800-616-3491. Union State Bank sponsors of the Whitney Radio Weather Phone at 914-636-7026.
Our weather forecast for today, it's going to be a little bit of patchy cloud cover for the morning hours. Then partly sunny and warm, our highs middle to upper 80s. We have the chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon and tonight. Nighttime low temperatures only into the middle 60s with a chance of storms. Daytime on Friday, some showers in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Our highs for the day will range in from 74 to 79. Clear skies at night, lower 50s. Saturday sunshine, mid-70s. Sunday sunny in the middle 70s. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX and WVIP, the Whitney Radio Network.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center. Brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center. Right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
Oh, I love that song.
What song?
What a Day for a Daydream.
Never heard it.
You were just whistling it.
How's it go?
You know, what a day for a daydream.
Nope, sorry, never heard it.
You're doing it again.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Listen, I hate to break it to you, I'm not whistling.
Is this a joke?
Hey, I'm just sitting on the bus, minding my own business.
Okay, all right, I'm sorry. Oh, and you dropped this.
Oh, my Mega Millions lottery ticket.
Amazing things happen when you let yourself dream. So play New York's Mega Millions. Hey, you never know.
Want to play a New York Lottery game like Lotto, Take 5, or Mega Millions, but don't have the time to pick numbers? Just ask your New York Lottery retailer for a quick pick. The fun and easy way to play and win.
This is Larry Gottlieb of Entergy. I'd like to invite you and your family to join us for a new monthly radio program, Green on Energy. I think it's a very special opportunity to discuss and explore all aspects of the color green and exactly what it means in the whole world of energy. For instance, what does green really mean when you're talking about the environment? And speaking of green, where's the smart money being invested in energy these days? And finally, on this new monthly radio show, we'll talk about giving a green light, if you will, to the energy projects and the new energy ideas our quality of life needs.
That's Larry Gottlieb of Entergy Corporation. He and other energy experts will be with you the first Wednesday of every month with Green on Energy at 12 noon. Right here at 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold, your host for this series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, September 27th, 2007, the fifth day of autumn. Say goodbye to summer, folks. And it's the day after the full moon. We have lost 3 minutes of daylight since yesterday, an hour and 14 minutes since last we met 4 weeks ago. The event that has occurred since then is the autumnal equinox, the moment when the sun's ecliptic, that is its apparent path, crossed the equator on its southern journey, a journey which may humble us as we contemplate that it has done exactly that since long before the dinosaurs and even the plants arose on this earth. Before, in fact, the very first bacteria emerged from the primal soup as the first expression of life on our planet. Inexorably, inevitably, immutably, the autumnal equinox. The sun rose 6:47 this morning, and it will set at 6:44 this evening. We will have 11 hours and 57 minutes of daylight today. The moon will rise at 7:01 this evening. It will set at 7:43 tomorrow morning. We are, as I said, 1 day past full moon, and the next full phase will occur on October 26th. Round and round we go. Eastern Standard Time returns on October 28th, 1 month and 1 day from today. Next high tides, New Rochelle, 6:23 this evening in Yonkers, about 8 minutes ago at 10:01, and in Dobbs Ferry in about 20 minutes at 10:29. Those are the high tides. Now our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. The following men all died 9 days ago on September 18th. In other words, they were all alive when last we met, which saddens me greatly. Specialist Matthew J. Emerson, age 20, from Grandview, Washington. He's from the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, and this was what they call a non-combat related incident. I haven't the slightest idea what that means. I don't hear about people dropping dead all over the place around here in New Rochelle and in New York City. What's a non-combat death? You're in the Army or the Marines. You're in a combat zone. What kills you? I mean, do you get the flu? Does somebody run over you with their bicycle? How do you die if it's non-combat? I mean, I guess they just don't want to rack up the combat numbers. I really don't know. Anyway, the next three honestly did die from a roadside bomb. They were all in the same unit, and they all died in the same incident. They were all with the 2nd Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade, 2nd Infantry. Names: Specialist Joseph N. Landry III, age 23, from Pensacola, Florida. Specialist Nicholas P. Olson, age 22, from Novato, California. Specialist Donald E. Valentine III, age 21, Orange Park, Florida. And finally, we lost Specialist Aaron J. Walker, age 23, from Harker Heights, Texas. He was with the 1st Armored Division. He was killed also on September 18th by small arms fire during combat operations in Baghdad. Let me bring that home to you a little bit. Small arms fire means someone either shot him with a rifle or a pistol or a grenade, small arms, that's what it is. So if you're walking down the street, of course you're not in Baghdad, but if you're walking down the street and somebody shoots you, that's what happened to Specialist Aaron J. Walker, who was 23 years old, serving his country honorably. May these American soldiers and Marines live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Okay, now it's time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, ballets, opera, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. Today we make short shrift of a couple of movies, Russell Crowe's 310 to Yuma and Jodie Foster's The Brave One, and very short shrift because we don't really have time. We have two great guests and I want to get to them. So all I'm going to say is save your money on Russell Crowe's 310 to Yuma, Jodie Foster's The Brave One, and if you want the full review, call me and I will read it to you. However, on a higher note, we have the Broadway production of Monty Python's Spamalot and the concert, which we just saw last night, which was called Three Mo' Tenors. Spamalot. Spamalot is why you go to Broadway musicals. We love this one. It is toe-tapping music with rememberable tunes and sharp, intelligent lyrics. It never takes itself seriously and, in fact, could not, as there is nothing, there is nothing in it to take itself seriously about. The star performer by far is Marin Mazzie as the Lady of the Lake. I hope I pronounced that right. A Broadway veteran for good reason, Ms. Mazzie has Tony nominations for Kiss Me Kate, Ragtime and Passion, and an Olivier Award nomination, which is the London equivalent of the Tonys, for Kiss Me Kate. She is a TV veteran as well, Without a Trace and Numbers, among many others. Ms. Mazzie has an operatic quality voice and great versatility in both singing and acting. I really enjoyed watching her act as well as listening to her sing. Really a fine voice, strong and rich without being shrill. It's great. Jonathan Hattery as King Arthur, who's been an actor for 39 years, is adequate and professional, but no longer up to par as a singer. While Ms. Mazzie empowers your ears, Mr. Hattery is decidedly weaker, and it amuses me that at the end, just as a matter of form, since Jonathan Hattery plays King Arthur, the main role, he's the one who comes out last. He's the one who supposedly gets the biggest applause, and yet he wasn't really the star. So I don't know how that works. I guess you have to do it that way. You get the applause you get in the order that they assign you. Nonetheless, all the actors in Spamalot seem always to be enjoying themselves on stage. The only character who does not exude joy at being on the Schubert Theater stage is the Wooden Rabbit. James Ludwig is notable as standby in the role of Sir Robin. And did I mention the Babes? Another fine feature of the Broadway musical, certainly so in Spamalot. Six scantily clad nubile dancers cavort in their almost all together, displaying an almost indecent joy in showing their lovely, lively bodies off. The players involve the audience at several points, once when the Holy Grail is discovered, and again at the end when they are invited to sing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life along with the cast. The confetti is cool too. If you've not yet seen this musical, which has been running since March 2005, do yourself a favor and go. And last night, we saw Three Mo' Tenors, which is a concert, not a play. If you love Pavarotti, Domingo, and Carreras, you will probably like these three, too. These three being D.C. natives James Berger and Duane Moody, and Georgia native Victor Robertson. Their rich, highly trained operatic voices are on beat and on key, with trivial exceptions. There are two full casts, by the way, as the roles are demanding and they require a day of rest in between shows for each of the performances, very understandably so. But these brilliant voices are underutilized. Not sure who to blame, but somewhere between musical director Keith Burton, who is a fine pianist, and musical supervisor and arranger Joseph Joubert, the best of these tenors is left on the shelf. The singers sang most of the duets and trios in unison rather than harmony, and as any capable composer can tell you, if you have three fine violinists, you give them counterpoint, you give them harmonies. It was frustrating to hear in one number after another the same rich voices on the same notes. These men are clearly up to the challenge of harmonies. Well, why not write them into the arrangements? There was little subtlety, too, in most of the numbers, just flat-out singing in full voice, whether in operatic arias, blues, gospel, jazz, or any of the other 10 genres of music included in the show. But these criticisms have little to do with the singers themselves. Their personalities shone with charm and humor, and their voices were worthy of the New York stage just off Broadway. They would blow away the best of American Idol contestants and deserve better material and arrangements in which to bring their talents to the Little Schubert stage. The show opens tonight after a short preview run, and that is Three Mo' Tenors at the Little Schubert Theater on 42nd Street in Manhattan. If you love tenor singing, that's the play for you. Okay, my first guest is John Cronin, director and CEO of the Beacon Institute in Beacon, New York. John, in his first incarnation, worked for the Clearwater, that's the sloop, which is mostly associated with Pete Seeger, at the goading of Pete Seeger, in fact. And John says that you can't hang out with Pete for very long before he makes you do something in his behalf. He became a fisherman on the Hudson River back when fish taken from the river were properly edible. He has written a book with Bobby Kennedy Jr. called The River Keepers in 1997 and was the very first full-time river keeper himself. There are now bay keepers and sound keepers all over the world. Welcome, John Cronin.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing good, and I have to ask how you're doing, because I know you you came down with something, and I hope that you're functioning very well today.
I'm doing much better than I was doing yesterday. Thanks
That's
for
great.
Asking.
I'm really glad to hear that. And you're speaking to us from Troy, New York, correct?
Yeah, I'm up in Troy today, yeah, at our office up here.
Now, I was up in Troy once. I was an extra in that movie with directed by Scorsese. It was a real period piece. I never can remember the name. Age of Innocence. I was a director in that, and that was in Troy.
Troy is a great river town, and one of the great things about the Hudson River Valley are these beautiful old cities that grew up along the river, and still have so much to offer. And many of them, like Troy, are now bouncing back and becoming little capitals of culture in the Hudson River Valley. And it's a wonderful place.
Well, that's why they chose Troy, because of the facades of the building were fit into the period, which is, I don't know, sometime back in the 30s maybe. And I don't know if you know this. Here's a little local color for you. They imported truckloads and truckloads of dirt, which they put down on the street, which we were using as a set to make it look, you know, it wasn't paved. They actually did that. It was truckloads and truckloads. Very interesting. Okay, John, you're the first American riverkeeper. But the tradition goes back to England, does it not?
Yeah. I was riverkeeper from 1983 to 2000. And the idea was to have somebody on the river whose job it was to look out for the river, to investigate polluters, to patrol the river, to bring together scientists and attorneys to work on river problems. And the idea did come from England, where private fishing clubs used to have river keepers that looked over their little private trout and salmon streams. But the idea here was to have a river keeper who worked in the public interest. So I was lucky enough to get the job. It was started by the Hudson River Fishermen's Association.
So yeah,
I did it for 17 years, and it was a lot of fun, a lot of challenge. We brought more than 100 polluters to justice one way or another over the period of 17 years, and we launched programs all over the world. So it was a tremendous success.
Well, besides arresting plural, getting finding justice where pollution was concerned, you've actually had obviously some fascinating experiences riding up and down on a relatively small powerboat, I presume, right?
Yeah.
Up and down the Hudson River. Did you go all the way down to the New York Harbor?
Oh, sure.
So
sure.
From
we covered the whole river. It was fascinating. We had a patrol boat, and we encountered, and we did a lot of work on land also, but we encountered everything from oil tankers rinsing themselves out illegally on the river to illegal landfills discharging waste into the river to, there was one, I was talking about New York Harbor, there was one, enormous discharge in coming from a little town called West New York, New Jersey, which is right across from Manhattan, and periodically this very large discharge, which is from a sewage treatment plant, would just turn completely red, and we couldn't figure out why this discharge would all of a sudden turn red in the course of a day. And it turns out there is a maraschino cherry factory that periodically would let loose the juice. And so we encountered all sorts of bizarre and strange things.
But that's not really pollution, is it?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of things that get discharged in something like that, that use up oxygen, that, you know, illegal colors in the water. And, you know, we don't want a red river. So there were some fascinating experiences. The other one I'll mention to you quickly, which is always a great story, was West Point Military Academy, which had a problem because the discharge, the flow of sewage into its sewage treatment plant would overwhelm the sewage treatment plant. And after a lot of investigation, we figured out that life was so regimented at West Point Military Academy that everybody flushed their toilets within about 15 minutes of each other. It was one of those great little amusing behind-the-scenes stories.
So they would overload the treatment plant, probably.
Yeah.
Now, don't they dye the Hudson River green on St. Patrick's Day?
No, it's the Chicago River.
Oh, okay. But so, all right, I was just kind of hung up on that maraschino cherry juice. It just seemed like that wouldn't be the worst pollution you'd come across. But anyway, you've also been in some harm, I presume. I read where you you pulled alongside a big tanker, maybe Exxon or one of the big oil companies, mm-hmm. and they were discharging into the river, and you had to get up there and test their effluent. To see what was in it, and you found it to be quite toxic. But I would think that in a small boat next to a huge tanker, you're kind of at risk, no?
Our boat was 25 foot.
Well, that's tiny.
The tanker was 750 feet, about six stories high. So it was always a very humbling experience.
Well, people swat mosquitoes.
Next to an oil tanker, and usually, and what these tankers were doing are rinsing themselves out in the river. And they would let go their ballast tanks, which means that they would rise in the river a certain amount. And then somewhere during that process, their propellers would be, which are enormous, would be halfway out of the water. So we always wondered if, just to scare us, the captain might, crank up those propellers and turn us into so much baloney. But we were lucky that never happened.
Now, you also had some amusing, I guess, in retrospect, they're amusing. At the time, they were probably a little harrowing. You actually rescue a big fat man from a punctured raft?
Yeah, you know, when you're out in the river enough, you run into people doing all sorts of strange things. And, I've pulled people out of the river any number of times. And, one was a fellow who was floating around on a little air raft, and he had fallen asleep and drifted away from the shoreline, and then the air raft started to deflate. And I found him way out in the middle of the river clinging to a ever-deflating raft, and I had to pull him and the raft out of the river. And it's not an easy thing to actually pull people out of the river into a boat. It requires a lot of their cooperation. But, yeah, people do strange things on the Hudson. They underestimate it, which is the most dangerous thing they do.
Absolutely. There are certainly currents, and it's wider than you might imagine. If you're stuck in the middle of it, that's still a long swim, even if you're a good swimmer.
Yeah,
now,
absolutely.
Let's talk about power plants for a minute. We have the Indian Point situation, and also power plants around the nation kill 500 billion fish a year.
Mm-hmm.
Half trillion fish.
Yeah, power plants are a terrific example of the challenge that we faced in the 21st century. The big challenge in the 21st century, and global warming puts this into high relief, are the challenges of daily living. You know, the requirements of daily life, the things that we take for granted. We turn on a switch in our house and the electricity goes on, the light
right.
goes on in the ceiling or whatever. Our refrigerators, they all require power. And what we don't see is where that power comes from and what those power plants require. And power plants require water. 99% of the power plants that are out there require water.
As a coolant, right?
As a coolant and to create the steam that turns the turbines.
Oh, okay.
And on the Hudson River, enormous quantities of water are pulled out of the river every day to both cool power plants and create the steam that's necessary to turn the turbines. And this is true across the country as well. And you can't pull water out of the river without pulling fish with it. So the Indian Point plants, for example, use about 1 million gallons of water a minute. And then we have several other power plants on the river that also use water. And they kill enormous amounts of fish that get pulled into the plants. But it's not just the power plants. It's really ourselves. We need the electricity. We use the electricity. This is not some rogue industry that's off on its own, cranking out illegal toxic chemicals when we're not looking.
I understand that, but are we not a rogue species that we so arrogantly take the lives of so many other living creatures, or are fish just not to be reckoned with at all?
Well, we're certainly at the top of the chain, and we deal out a lot more harm than we should. And the power plants are a really good example. You know, worldwide, power plants probably kill about a trillion fish a year. And that's an enormous amount. And it all goes on invisibly. And it's stoppable. It's preventable.
I'm sure it is.
By any number of means. But one of the first things we need to know is where are the fish when? And the Beacon Institute, which I work at now and direct, our commitment is to create the kind of monitoring system on the Hudson River, you know, high-tech monitoring system that will tell us where the fish are when.
Now, is it?
And where chemicals are when, and how the river is behaving physically.
Now, John, is this part of your work with the Beacon Institute?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you can imagine.
John, let me just say, you are director and CEO of the Beacon Institute. We only have about 2.5 minutes left, and I definitely want you to talk about the Beacon Institute.
Yeah.
So in the next 2.5 minutes, tell us what they do and what you do with them.
The Beacon Institute was formed to do research about the world's rivers and estuaries for application to policy and education. And the world's rivers and estuaries are where most of the population lives. And so the biggest impact on the environment, you know, kind of centers around the world's rivers and estuaries. And what we are doing, and IBM is a big partner with us in this enterprise, is we are endeavoring to create in the river a network of sensors and technology that will tell us how the river is behaving, just like we can turn on the radio and hear the weather. Through this network of sensors and monitoring, we are be able to know in real time what's happening on the river, physically, chemically, and biologically. With that kind of information, we can manage and protect the river almost on a minute-to-minute basis, just like you'd wake up in the morning and turn on the radio and it would say, bring your umbrella today. It's going to start raining in about an hour.
Okay.
We still have that kind of up-to-date information on the river as well.
Okay, now just give us a moment about the cleanup of the Hudson River by General Electric, the PCBs that they illegally dumped. They've been mandated to do it, and
yes.
I think you said that George Pataki actually called in some political chips.
Yeah, one of the great untold stories here is that the Bush administration was not eager to order the General Electric Company to do a cleanup. Almost nobody expected the Bush administration to order General Electric to do a cleanup.
I personally was shocked when they did.
Yeah, but former Governor George Pataki called in a lot of political chips and behind the scenes used his political influence, or a powerful Republican state governor to a Republican presidential administration, to get the Bush administration, EPA, to order a cleanup. And it was a heroic effort. There were a lot of ways that the governor could have used those political chips that he had accumulated, but he chose to use them for the Hudson River. And for that reason, you know, I think we're all, and many others, that environmental initiative and many other environmental initiatives were in his debt.
Great. Thanks, John. I know that you have a meeting to go to, and we have to take our break, so I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much. I hope we'll do it again sometime.
Thank you very much. That'll be my pleasure. And just before we go to break, I'd like to just tell you this program is brought to you in part by the Learning Shop of Harrison, New York. You may reach them at 914-835-1070. There are all kinds of businesses and other tutoring companies, but the Learning Shop is set apart by their personnel and their company culture. There is something about education that invites structure without rigidity, discipline without anxiety, teaching without stuffiness. The management and staff at the Learning Shop are friendly, educated, and flexible, not just intelligent, but smart as well. The distinction is an important one. Most teachers are intelligent, but that is kind of an internal trait. When intelligence comes out into the room and has the ability to touch others, it becomes smart. John and Paul head up the operation, and their even-tempered personalities inspire the atmosphere of relaxed learning. It is a pleasure to visit their facility, where there is always a friendly space in which to share ideas and for students to study in quiet and harmony under expert tutelage. If you or someone you know could benefit from private instruction, give the Learning Shop of Harrison a call at 914-835-1070. You will be very happy with their services. Again, 914-835-1070. You are listening to WBOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening in Brooklyn or Troy, New York, or on a train between New York and Boston, you have logged on to www.wvox, or you are waiting on the telephone to come on, and we will be right back.
I never dreamed of what it would feel like to lose my only child. I watched her flying towards the windshield, and I closed my eyes. But what I didn't see was a seatbelt pulling her back into place, saving her life, giving my daughter a chance to pursue her dreams, and giving me the chance to watch her do it.
You've been given the gift of life, so why take a chance on losing it? Get it together. Buckle up.
Sponsored by the New York State Governor's Traffic Safety Committee in cooperation with the New York State Broadcasters Association.
In recent years, thousands of New York area companies that were, shall we say, a little behind the technology curve. Now, mind you, I'm not suggesting they were completely computer illiterate, but I think you get the idea. Anyway, they've now discovered Savvy Networks. This unique Westchester company pioneered in computer knowledge and technology 22 years ago. And today, Savvy Networks enjoys, I can tell you, a national reputation in healthcare, legal, and other professions as the leader in paper information privacy. Now, what that means is, simply put, Savvy Networks is the premier service provider helping companies preserve information assets and valuable intellectual capital. Savvy Networks protects your business contacts and those unique relationships you've built up over many years. They're priceless to you. Also, your essential accounting files. This amazing company, founded in Westchester, as I said, 22 years ago by Christopher Fury, is now firmly established as the preeminent off-site backup for critical data files, sometimes called in the jargon a vault. Others look to Savvy as a safe deposit box, if you will, for critical information. I'll give you just one example. Savvy now stores and secures the confidential medical records of some 30 million Americans. It's an internet vault or safe deposit box for your most critical information, and that's what they're all about. So to protect your assets, call Chris Fury, president of Savvy Networks. His number in Westchester is 914-345-0373. For a confidential analysis of your own information assets, so important to you, call Chris at 914-345-0373.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Judge Sandy Scherr, Karen and Jeff Birnbach, Janet and Ken Raske, head of the Greater New York Hospital Association, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
The Bronx, Westchester, and the Islands Worldwide Forum. This is WVOX, Whitney Radio's flagship station at 1460 AM and worldwide at WVOX.com. From the ancient Latin comes our name, and from the Roman Forum for discussion and debate comes our inspiration. Vox, the voice of the people, America's most honored community radio station. WVOX and WVOX.com.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
We are back. Welcome back to WVOX. This is Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lovensold. My next guest is best-selling author, a physician, surgeon. Among his 27 novels, 26 of which I have read, are Outbreak, Crisis, his current book, Critical, and the renowned Coma. Speaking to us from a rail car somewhere between New York City and Boston, welcome Robin Cook.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning. Are you still in New York? Are you in Massachusetts or what?
Between Boston and someplace.
Between. Okay. Our reception's not that great, but we'll do the best we can. In your current book, Robin, which is called Critical, you address specialty hospitals which are in business to make money and not to cure disease. In your last book, Crisis, you dealt with concierge practices, which is individual physicians who are also basically in medicine for the money. So apparently you perceive, and you're not necessarily happy with this trend in medicine to just make money. Is that in fact a trend, and how do you feel about it? Did we lose him? We lost him. Okay. I will ask that question either when he calls back, or we'll get it back. We'll get him back. In the meantime, before we get Robbie Cook back, which we will do, either he will call us or we will call him, I would like to just tell you about a cabinet which measures 40 inches wide, 38 inches high, and just 20 inches deep. It is the Manhattan Clam. We have Robin Cook back, so just keep the Manhattan Clam in mind. And if you want to see it, go to themanhattanclam.com. Robin Cook, are you back? Robin Cook, are you back? Okay. As we said, Robin Cook is on a rail car. This is the only way we could get him. He's a very busy guy. He's traveling between New York and Boston. In fact, in Boston, he's in discussions with Michael Eisner to do a major new motion picture, which will be released concurrent with his next book. In fact, he's going to India to do that, and that's why we're having trouble. So just bear with us, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the Manhattan Clam. It's a compact and beautiful furniture piece. It opens in seconds, whether you need it for a desk, a quick snack, or a large dinner party. It's called the Manhattan Clam. You can see it at themanhattanclam.com. And it is a really fine furniture piece, which I know. While we're waiting also, I'd like to just say something about Karl Rove. This was from an editorial that appeared August 14th, 2007. He was so much what has gone wrong with the Bush administration, because he's he is so focused on winning political contests. He's so into that he really lost any morality or ethics that he ever had. According to the New York Times, the American public needs to understand the full story of how this White House, with Mr. Rove pulling many of the strings — they call him the architect, but he's really the puppeteer — he spent the last 6.5 years improperly and dangerously politicizing the federal government. Robin Cook, are you back?
I'm back. I'm a little concerned that this isn't working as well as we thought it might.
Well, you know, we do the best we can in radio and in medicine, right?
Yep.
At first, we do no harm. Okay, so let me just rephrase. Let me repeat the question. I was talking about, in your current book, Critical, and in your past book, Crisis, you deal with the question of in the case of Critical, specialty hospitals, and in the case of Crisis, concierge physicians, individual physicians who are basically in medicine for the money. You don't seem to like that, and you perceive that it is a trend. Is it in fact a trend, and how do you feel about it?
It is a trend. It's and it's a very disturbing trend, because it flies in the face of one of the three major pillars of medical ethics, and that is the idea of social justice. We're going to our medical system is going farther and farther towards just taking care of the rich or the fully insured. And the ranks of the uninsured are getting larger and larger. It's an unsustainable kind of a transition that we're going through.
Well, what I especially love about your books is that you take trends and you jazz them up. You make them interesting. You have your characters. Your Laurie, what's her last name? Laurie and Jack, I remember. and you put them in situations where your imagination just flourishes about how they how unscrupulous doctors who blow the codes all away take these things into thriller kind of things. Stem cell research. Can we talk about that? Joan, would you like to sing them a song? Joan shakes her head. No. Well, okay. I am told a late flash that two parts of the Patriot Act have been declared unconstitutional by a federal judge. Now, of course, we would expect the administration to go all out to try to counteract that, to try to overthrow that. But actually, they have been attacking the this administration has been attacking the Constitution since they got in, and I believe in our country as it was established, as the Constitution was written, that in order to secure the rights of Americans and the success of the American government, that we should have the Constitution does it, and if you take those rights away, you actually damage the country. Robin, do we have you back?
Yes, I'm here. I apologize.
It's not your fault. Nothing to apologize for. I started to ask you about stem cell research, the dangers of stem cell research, the potential benefits. Are there any objections to it other than moral ones? And is, in fact, the stem cell research, is that, in fact, the elixir of life, the what Ponce de Leon was looking for?
I actually think so. The first time that medicine is facing the opportunity to actually a whole host of diseases. One of the problems when you go into medicine, you have this idea that part of the motivation is to cure people. And it's really kind of an awakening, a rude awakening, when you realize that their opportunities to cure people are so seldom, except for perhaps sore throats, et cetera, but most of those would cure themselves anyway.
Right.
But to truly cure someone, maybe appendicitis, you take the appendix out, and I think that was why I was initially attracted to surgery.
Taking out appendixes?
Because, you know, you actually cure someone. You have someone with a potentially lethal situation, and you take the appendix out, and they're cured.
Yeah, and they could die of peritonitis, right?
Excuse me?
Yeah, I say they could die of peritonitis if you did not remove it. Okay.
I'm having difficulty hearing you, and even while we stay connected,
okay.
I think maybe we're going to have to try to do this on another day, and I can be at a landline in my office.
I'd be happy to do that, but don't bail on us just yet. I think we can still make something out of this. People understand that that what's going on. Cell phone.
I'm having difficulty hearing the question, and not going to sound like a particularly smart person to you if I can't hear the question.
Okay, we hear you fairly well, actually. Can we talk more about stem cells? You want to try?
Yeah, I can try a little bit more.
Okay.
As I was saying, it's an opportunity to actually cure people, and so that's why many of us are so excited about this and very disappointed that there are some people who say that they're pro-life and are taking a stand that is so against being pro-life.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Does stem cell research actually, could it actually be the elixir of immortality? Can it actually rejuvenate the body on an ongoing basis?
No, I don't think it's going to do anything like that. Although it is interesting to notice that if you take an adult cell, an adult nucleus, when it is put into an egg cell, it is reverted to being very, very young, which is another part of the extraordinary thing that happens with these stem cells. It just defies belief. The equivalent would be is taking an old car and ripping the engine out and then throwing another engine in, and not only does the car work, but it's brand new.
Well, could you then not just keep on replacing that? I mean, cars can go forever if you keep replacing parts.
You know, I don't think if there's going to be anything about the immortality, which I kind of doubt. But it's not going to come from stem cell research. It's going to come from the research into the whole process of aging itself. There's lots of ideas about the changes that go on and the terminal portions of chromosomes, et cetera, and being able to reverse that. And I think that that kind of research is certainly going to continue. I think we might be able to extend life to some degree, but just not part of the original design.
Uh-huh, I get it. Your next book, you won't tell us about, but you're creating a film with Michael Eisner, is that right?
Well, actually, I signed do not disclose agreements. I really can't talk about it.
Oh, did I already spill too much by saying you're working with Michael?
Yes, I
think
so. Oh,
I'm sorry. I'll drop that one right now. Tell me who's going to win between the Yankees and the Red Sox, since you're both Boston and a New Yorker.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
Well, since you have residences in both New York and Boston, you must have some thought about the Yankees and the Red Sox, yes or no?
Oh, I have a great amount of ambivalence. I grew up close to the Yankee Stadium, was always a Yankee fan, and when I collect cards when I was a child, and now I'm in Boston mostly, and the degree of patriotism that the Boston fan extend towards their team, it's kind of it's almost like a disease. you catch it, and so I found myself worrying about the Yankees.
Interesting. You know, I also grew up quite close to Yankee Stadium. I didn't realize that we come from the same place. Perhaps another time we can discuss it. Let me read you a quote. This is a lady named Maureen Daly, whose mother developed an infection after shoulder surgery, and you get into nosocomial disease very much in Critical. In fact, in Critical, you have the evil guy actually causes deaths and disguises them as if they were nosocomial. This lady says, "I have lost friends," and this is real life, not your book. "I have lost friends to breast cancer, to AIDS, to car accidents, to things we don't have answers to. That I lost my mother to someone not washing their hands or cleaning a hospital room properly is disgusting to me." How big a problem is nosocomial disease?
An enormous problem. And it's getting worse, because mainly because the bacteria are getting, just are immune to all of our antibiotics. There's only a couple of antibiotics for some of these strains now. So the bugs are getting worse, and a lot of hospitals just didn't seem to, or hadn't, until recently, a lot of hospitals just didn't seem to be willing to change certain systems that seem to encourage the development of these infections. And it's a huge problem today, and it's getting worse. There are some hospitals that are doing a lot, particularly in Europe, and they show that changing certain things, whatnot. There's ways of dealing with it, and lowers the incidence of infection dramatically.
I think I read that the VA is actually addressing that more than anybody else. Am I correct? The Veterans Administration, I read somewhere that they were taking it very seriously and they were in the forefront. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do, that they have. And it's one of the benefits of the way that the VA is organized. And it's the way that all health care in this country is going to have to be organized. We have to go to a single-payer plan where things of this sort can be dealt with on a national scale. It's almost ridiculous that we have what we call a health system. It's really not a system. Because if you say something's a system, you think that it works together. It doesn't. We have thousands of little cottage industries here, there, and everywhere. And there's no way to deal with some sort of problem like this. It's just another example or another indication that we have to go to a single-payer, organized system in this country, like every other industrialized nation.
Well, I have read that the VA system, the Veterans Administration healthcare system, is actually among the best health delivery systems in the country. And when I was growing up, I had heard it was pretty bad. My personal experiences with it are quite good. They take good care of me. Do you agree that the VA actually is an example of a federal program that really works well and should set an example for society as a whole?
You know, I do. I also changed because initially I didn't think the VA system, I kind of looked down my nose at it while I was in my, that rotations at the VA system that some of us did in residency programs, et cetera, always didn't seem to be up to snuff, so to speak. But that's changed, and there's just, I guess there's just been a lot better administration of it, And I think it does stand as a good example of what could be done for medicine in general.
And it's really, I believe, quite economical as the federal government delivers it. So what if the next administration, let's just suppose that Hillary Clinton becomes the president and she has taken this issue very seriously, do you think that it would be feasible with the proper leadership to create a healthcare system that did, in fact, reflect the administration of the Veterans Administration?
I think it could stand for as a good example, but unfortunately, as you see, that the evolution of Hillary Clinton's health ideas, I mean, she's trying to be more pragmatic now. The problem with her previous plan is that it relied too much on managed care, which was a way of denying care, actually. Now we have a system now that favors too much care. You have to come out sort of in the middle. And I have a fear that she's going to try to satisfy too many people with the program that she's presenting right now. All I can hope is that perhaps she's saying this during the campaign, and then once she became president, I would hope that she would try to be a little bit more to change things a bit more than what she's suggesting now, because now it's just kind of more of the same. It's mostly kowtowing to the insurance industry.
So what, I mean, America, that's American politics. If you don't play ball with the people with money, and if you don't tell the people what they want to hear, you don't win. What happens?
Well, you know why I can feel slightly optimistic about this? Because I could foresee in the not-too-distant future that big business might align itself to get rid of health care. Big business liked health care a long time ago because it was a way of, a relatively cheap way of dealing with the unions, et cetera, to give a little more medical care here and there and whatever. But big business now really is saddled with it because the industries that they compete with on a global basis are not saddled with it. And big business should say, you know, let's get out of here and let's have the government take it over or somebody. Why should business be saddled with health care? It just really doesn't make any sense. And if big business suddenly decided it didn't want health care or business in general, and it sided with the people thinking that we should have some sort of single-payer plan, et cetera, some rational plan, I think then something really could happen.
Is that the train announcing your destination?
I'm sorry, I can hear the announcement of the train here coming to Providence.
Well, we'll listen. Okay, now we are speaking to Robin Cook, approaching Providence, Rhode Island. So, you know, that just adds color
and
to the broadcast.
And the sun just came out.
That is adding color and brightness to our broadcast. Okay, well, we're talking about healthcare, very important issue, of course. Now, Dr. Cook, you didn't sign a non-disclosure agreement about what you're doing today, right? You're going to Boston General to consult on a medical issue?
Yes. Well, I have a meeting at the hospital this afternoon, and I'm trying to help reorganize the emergency room service, which it really can't be reorganized in a certain sense. It can't be made appropriate because, no, with President Bush said, oh, everybody gets health care. They just can go to the emergency room. Well, that's just making operating an emergency almost impossible.
Obviously, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, but you have to try to do the best you can, and triage is very important and
critical.
Yes, it's very critical.
So Dr. Robin Cook is not only a best-selling New York Times best-selling author, but you're also very active in your first profession, which was medicine. Is that so?
Yes. I think of myself as a doctor who writes rather than the other way around.
Cool. Now, you mentioned it, incidentally. We have a couple of minutes. I'd like you to just talk about this. You were actually drafted into the Navy, as I recall, and you volunteered for submarine training. This was before you'd ever written a book, and you had time underwater. So your first book actually was written entirely on a submarine underwater. Is that so?
The first one,
The Day of the Intern.
The Year of the Intern.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the one book I haven't read. The Year of the Intern.
Well, I don't recommend it. I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me.
I can hear you. Just talk louder than that yoga.
Okay. I would just don't recommend too many people read that book unless they're particularly interested in personality development or non-development in physicians because of their training.
See, and that's the only one I haven't read, so now you let me off the hook. I don't have to read it. But what was your experience writing a book in a submarine, though?
Pardon me?
What was your experience? You had never written a book before. You had time on your hands, and you just sat down and wrote a novel. What was underwater?
I guess the hubris of being a doctor, you kind of feel like you can do anything. I'm not sure, but that's sort of the way I felt. I didn't know anything about writing. And so the first thing I really wrote, I couldn't write a 5-page paper in college. I stayed away from that.
And now you write these nice, wonderful, engaging, pot-boiling novels where we can just get into Laurie. What is her last name anyway? Laurie
Montgomery.
Say it again? Montgomery. Laurie Montgomery, right.
And Jack Stapleton.
And Jack Stapleton, although in truth Laurie is now Laurie Stapleton. I don't know. Did she take her husband's name or did she keep her own? Do you know that? Robin, do I have you? Robin, I need an answer to that question.
Can you hear me?
I can. Is she Laurie Stapleton, or did she keep her maiden name?
She has to keep her maiden name because it has to match her birth certificate as a physician.
Okay, so now you've cleared up that important question. I have to say goodbye to you. You hear Beethoven in the background?
Okay, well, I hope I can get reprieve and do this once more when I can hear a little better.
It'll be my great pleasure, Robin.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
Thank you. I would like to thank John Cronin and Robin Cook for taking the time out of their ginormously intense schedules to share time with us today. Without John, the Hudson River would not be even as clean as it is. And Robin Cook does three things very well. He educates about medical advances and research. He spotlights how unscrupulous people can find loopholes to advance greed. And he entertains with wonderfully intense characters. The only cure for boredom is curiosity. This is our thought for the week. There is no cure for curiosity. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health and happiness to you all.
Live from New York's Golden Apple, this is the flagship station of the Whitney Radio Network. 1460 WVOX.
Fresh evidence this morning that the credit crunch is hurting. The government reports new home sales really hit the skids last month. Let's get the story live from business editor Mark Hamrick.
That 8% decline was worse than expected, John, taking new home sales down to the slowest pace in 7 years. Builders are doing all they can to unload these homes in the face of canceled contracts and bloated inventories of